And fellow frogs, sister and fellow frogs, and those of indeterminate sister and fellowhood. As my friend Hisham Mohammed tells it, this year in Sudan, a peaceful revolution began in a college cafeteria when the price of flour rose astronomically and students could not afford to eat. Students organized boycotts and sit-ins. A flame of change ignited and began to spread through North Sudan. This is a simplistic description, but it's one that sparks Hisham's heart. Largely, the protesters from his home country who initially took to the streets were between the ages of 15 and 35. In North Sudan, 15 and to 35-year-olds comprise 41% of the country. They've been especially impacted in a polarized landscape where the opulent wealth of the few contradicts the poverty of the majority, coupled with cuts to healthcare and education spending. In the words of Rabah Omar, the Sudanese government understood that university environments were breeding grounds for resistance and community organizing. So they cracked down with increasingly restrictive measures. And the students? As you may know, they participated in marches of bread and dignity, even though the government brought militia in, even though people lost their lives, several in each protest. Hisham knows a man who lost both feet when the police lobbed an exploding canister at his feet. The young people used WhatsApp, Facebook, and Twitter to announce the next peaceful demonstrations for freedom and justice, and city after city, they kept marching. They were not alone. There were lawyers who donated their services. There were people who raised funds for them. There were medical teams who serviced not only the protesters who were injured, but those in the country who could not afford health care. And the European Union and the United States spoke up in favor of supporting the youth. In June, the declaration of the youth forces of the April 6th revolution, quote, pointed to the need for the amendment of the election law to include the proportion lists of youth representing 30% of the seats of the legislative councils at the national and states level. This is strong stuff, friends. This September, I will be 50. Not old, but no longer the young people, though I still get called that and mistaken for it in organizations I belong to. That says more about the organizations than it does about me. I have been thinking a lot about the world I was born into and the world that we live in today. When I was born, the polar ice caps were much larger, and the impact of the recently proliferating civil rights and women's movements informed Saturday morning cartoons portraying a world where difference was valued, as in Schoolhouse Rock's Melting Pot video. Could you please raise your hand if you know that video, the Melting Pot video? Okay, could you please raise your hand if you're over 50? No, you don't have to. But not everyone knows this video, and that just speaks to my point. This video pays homage to Lady Liberty in the New York Harbor and proclaims a recipe for the American melting pot of immigrants, Armenians, Africans, English, Italians, Chinese, Poles, Puerto Ricans, and so forth. Its early 70s context does fail to acknowledge Native Americans as the actual original inhabitants here, and claims that the immigrants made the country, but the principle still sticks. As the words go, our heritage is mixed, so any kid could be the president. You simply melt right in. It doesn't matter what your skin. I do not think it's an accident that President Obama was born just 8 years before me, or that hope was a big part of his message. See, hope is the gift that my generation was endowed with, born of the hard work of generations before us. It was a particular kind of hope. Other generations have had hope. But the whole tenor of my childhood was based on a belief in the equality of persons and that this was already actualized. In the 70s, we thought it was actualized already. The theme figured so prominently that many Caucasians, when they saw the resurgence of evident isms and prejudice and discriminatory acts, really sank into despair because we didn't get it. We thought, well, what was our childhood about anyway? Still, this belief and hope that the inherent worth and dignity of every human being will be recognized by the more equitable distribution of wealth and opportunity is one of the most persistent tools in our toolkit. Every generation born into a slightly different world is born also with different tools and access to them. For example, as you know, today's youth possess an ease with technology that seems innate to those of us slightly older because it's been present in their lives since birth. They also have greater mobility and a different kind of mobility, whether it be job mobility or traveling through the country. The cell phone makes many more things possible. And in the words of my former student, Katrina, who is now age 32, and please forgive me for using this word in church, I'm quoting, they don't take bullshit. A word that I've actually never used in my life. But Katrina is traveling the country in a Chevy conversion van on a year-long trip that she hopes will culminate in entering an herbalist program in California. She had this idea 5 years ago, around the time her father died. She had been wondering what happened to her childhood dream of being a farmer. Like me, she finds that those dreams put inside us as children have a real impact on us. Just take a second. Just think about what dreams entered you as children. Katrina, as a young adult, wound up doing a stint of woofing, working on a farm in exchange for her keep. This is something that I never heard about when I was 32. The owner of the farm was Buddhist, and his brother was a Christian. One day they said a blessing on the meal in which the Buddhist prayed to the Christian gods and the Christian prayed to the Buddhist gods. Katrina's dream of farming reawakened through this simple example of embodied and non-judgmental love. Next, she met two powerful older women who were herbalists and healers. She had always felt that she was a healer, but didn't know how to use her gifts. She researched tiny houses, another toolkit piece that people have now, and then she bought an ambulance, refurbished it. It broke down, and eventually she got refurbished and worked on the mechanics of the Chevy conversion van. She set out to explore beauty, to see where to root herself, and where to found her business called Biokia, named after a stuffed animal cow she had as a child. Her exploration is also a conscious journey to learn how to be a strong and powerful woman. She wants to create something that will help the world, an apothecary of plant remedies for which she doesn't want to charge money, as she feels that the earth gives freely. And she wants to figure out what else to do financially to support this dream. Her experience is that those in her family lineage, for whatever reasons, haven't been able to pass down the wisdom and strength, the crucial information that she needs to be a powerful creator, and through her creations, an agent of change. She needs and longs for, and on this journey is searching for, more elders. I've heard this repeatedly from other former students and young people I meet. I asked Katrina, if a genie could grant you whatever you most need from your elders, what would you want? And she replied, intentional relationships. When I joined South Church half my lifetime ago, quite literally, like really half my lifetime ago, the first person I met was Ellen Forbes, Let's just do another show of hands. Who knew Ellen Forbes? Okay, a fair number of you. That is because if you were here, you knew Ellen Forbes because she was a matriarch in our community. Descended on both sides from Margaret Fuller, she used her voice. Often, she used her voice to ask me to do things. Before long, I was co-organizing our yearly women's service with other church matriarchs, like Anthea Smith, who was the young kid in the crowd, who's sitting here today. Shout out to Anthea. I served on the Special Sunday Services Committee. I made calls to legislators to protest proposed discriminatory legislation. I helped with the yard sale. I coordinated parts of the singles group where everyone else was 18 to 30 years older than me. I went to the UU Women's Federation suppers and the monthly women's group and everything else I was asked to do. And while I was at it, since working with her had taught me how to do things in this church, and since I didn't get why we didn't have a high school youth group, I went to our minister, Bob Carnan, and offered to start a high school youth group, exactly when church member Steve Cole did the same thing, and we founded one for our teens that year. Why really did I do all these things? Yes, they went with my ideals. But really, truly, it was because Ellen extended herself to me. Like others she extended herself to, I learned that I had something to give. I knew by the way she smiled and said, "Jennifer," that somehow, inexplicably, she felt I was helping her life. Meanwhile, Ellen encouraged and cared for me. She had me house sit when I was between places to live because I had left a job without taking a new one. She put a newspaper cutting about my nominations for Poet Laureate in my door. When I worried that maybe I had a little OCD because I had started cleaning my house and even at 2 a.m. I was still straightening the pillows, and she had been a therapist, she said to me, "Jennifer, we all have a little OCD. I always go back to check and see if my stove is on, but my house has never burned down." Repeatedly, she suggested that I become a Unitarian Universalist minister. It is in no small part because of Ellen that I am a hospice chaplain today, and it is a small sorrow that she passed before I became one. What we had was the model of an intentional relationship, and I, the 24-year-old, did not start it. She did. Katrina, my old student, describes intentional relationships between generations as two-way communication. But it seems to her that nowadays, the people from her generations are often the ones making the effort. As elders, we can reach out more consistently, check in, and ask questions. And if you're sitting here and you're 24, you're still an elder, and you're going to be more of one. So Katrina notes that growing up with technology, some people in her age group don't have as many skills for reaching out in person. Millennials also can feel like there were movements in the 1960s, but those movements got lost. She emphasizes that the coming generations don't need us to tell them how they should live, just to model interpersonal connection and let them know we are there so they can reach out when they need us. They need to know we care about you and we are our resources. And we will bring openness instead of justice. Ah, no, judgment. We will bring justice. That was the heat. You know, when I left my job unwisely without having something to do and my lease ended and I had nowhere to go, I might as well have been living the parable of the prodigal son. And there was Ellen to say, "Come in, here, put some shoes on your feet. I know you squandered a little bit, but I have faith. Let's celebrate that you are here. Let's kill the fatted calf," or in her case, the quahogs. Often, you might be interested to know. Maybe you know this. Millennials see their elders as too politically charged, pinned to the left or right. And they feel they need to mediate that line in a way that is progressive but not polarizing. They often feel that we have too many biases based on our past experiences and our facts. They can be afraid of our leaders and want to chuck them out of office. Sometimes they even see them as robots or monsters and forget that everyone has a story and reasons to make those decisions because they are ready for change. And alongside these feelings, they are out there protesting Washington, D.C. and on social media, living out the fact that the personal is political, and helping to bring forth Black Lives Matter and Me Too and so many other movements that are just starting to burgeon. The fact is, we don't know what we're going to need next, but the likelihood is that, as in North Sudan, the generations coming are the ones who will midwife what we need into being. While Katrina mentions the prodigal son as one of her favorites, she also mentions the story of Ruth and Naomi. This is my all-time favorite story from the Bible. You may recall that Ruth had been widowed, as had both of her daughters-in-law. Naomi had lost her husband and both of her sons, and Ruth had lost her husband. Ruth was in her homeland, but Naomi was not. She was far away, and she said, "I will go. I will leave Moab. I will take my grief, and I will go, and you stay here. Your life is here." But as she faced Naomi on that lonely road, Ruth's heart was sure and clear. Ruth spoke, "Do not plead with me to turn back from accompanying you, for where you go, I shall go." As someone who works in hospice, I now think of aging and of the time of passing that will come to us all every day. And I want to be accompanied. I want to accompany, and I want to be accompanied for all the days of my life. My grandmother at age 94 told me that the secret to growing old is having younger friends. And I hope that even now, years after her physical passing, I can still accompany Ellen Forbes on a shared journey. Our relationship will never end, for I am forever changed by what she gave me. My heart is sure and clear. I will continue to carry out and live our shared values. I use what she taught me. And in those moments when I fall into despair, and sometimes I do, I think of Ellen, and there is no more despair. Where she would go, I will go.